Welcome, everyone, to the new Breaking Kayfabe. I'm your host, Jeff Bowdern, and my co-host, Barry Rose. Barry, how you doing?
Man, I'm doing great, Jeff. I am sitting here. I've got my trusty, loyal companion, Ozzy, by my side, a big cup of coffee, and I am ready to rock and roll today.
All right. And on this show, we are not just going to break kayfabe on the wrestling business. We will break kayfabe on sports, movies, television, music, pop culture. We're going to break kayfabe on life. And on today's show, we're going to be discussing three of my top 100 matches of the 80s. I'm really excited about this one, Barry, because the third match I'm going to talk about, holy crap, what a lot of fun that one was. And I think that you know the one I'm talking about. And besides that, we're also going to be finishing up my top 21 memories of the 80s. We gave you 11 before. We're going to the top 10 this week. And finally, we are going to discuss the worst Seinfeld episodes ever.
Worst Seinfeld episodes ever? You mean that they're actually bad episodes of Seinfeld?
You know, bad Seinfeld is still better than most. But there were a couple stinkers they put out there, and Barry and I are going to discuss them. And that is not including the finale, which most people seem to think is a big pile of crap. But anyway, so Barry, you ready to go?
Let's do this. So you mentioned that of the three matches we're talking about, we're saving one, I guess, is the third match. And that's the big one right there?
That's the big one. We're going to – no spoilers. We're going to start –
spoilers.
We're going to start on April 19th of 1986, the Crockett Cup in New Orleans, Louisiana. I was there for the Crockett Cup, and the match that stole the weekend was the Fantastics versus the Sheepherders. Barry, you had a chance to watch this. Tell me what you think.
Yeah, so I watched this match, too, and I have to admit, so I remember seeing the Crockett Cup, and I think I saw it on video. I don't think I saw it on pay-per-view or anything like that, and this match stood out. There was a lot of mediocrity on that card, if I recall correctly. But I did have a chance. I went back and I watched this match over the last few days. And I got to tell you, this was a fantastic match. And that's obviously, I didn't even mean that as far as a play on words with the Fantastics. But so a couple of notes that I have on this one was the Fantastics, I was never a big fan. And I think part of it was, maybe it was the ass wiggling that really got it for me. I absolutely hated to see these two guys in the ring wiggling their asses. I could almost take the strut, but I couldn't take the ass wiggling. But as workers, Bobby Fulton is horrifically underrated because I think a lot of people always overlooked him and said, well, Tommy Rogers, who may have been the better of the two workers, but Fulton really gets overlooked a lot, and I think by comparison. The Sheepherders, you know, to me, what a success story in the sense that these guys were these killer heels, these maniacal heels. Then they get over as these fan-friendly, goofy baby faces in the WWE. So really, congratulations to them. So a couple of notes about this that really stood out to me. Tommy Rogers, 100% solid in everything that he actually does. I don't see a flaw in anything that he did in his game whatsoever. Bobby Fulton's dropkick, that's a really good dropkick. Nobody ever says the name Bobby Fulton when you hear about a dropkick. His dropkick was tremendous. And there's a spot, too. He does a dropkick outside of the ring on the floor. Did you see that?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, absolutely incredible. But this match, great brawl. Lots of blood. I think everybody's bleeding in this match. Love the fact that Jack Victory is there as the flag bearer. You've got Lady Maxine, which I think is great. But I love this match. I think this is just such a good tag match. They also had this other match, too, if I recall correctly. It was the barbed wire cage match, which I also thought was great. But Sheepherders, diametrically opposed to their character in the WWE. And the Fantastics, honestly, if you get rid of the clip-on bow ties and the ass wiggling, I think I really would have enjoyed these guys more.
Well, I think the Fantastics always were compared to the Rock and Roll Express. And I think where they faced some problems as far as acceptance from the crowd was that they were the second rock and roll team that came through Mid-South in the UWF, because, you know, the Rock and Roll Express was the first, you know, rock and roll babyface tag team. And they got over so huge in Mid-South and that area. And then when they went to Crockett, they were the first rock and roll team in Crockett. So, you know, the Fantastics had a habit of following them. So even though they were perceived as not being as big an attraction as the Rock and Roll Express, they were every bit as good a tag team as the Rock and Roll Express. You're absolutely right. They're very underrated from that point of view. Like I said, best match of the tournament. The tournament, like I said, I went up to New Orleans and saw this, and I couldn't believe that there weren't more people there. I was like, wow, they got all these really good tag teams. It's going to be an interesting tournament, you know. And I was talking to somebody last night, and I mentioned, and I just want to get your thoughts on this. I could never understand. Now, let's be honest. This is a tournament with Crockett and Bill Watts as the main promoters of this. I mean, they brought in guys from Memphis, and I think maybe they had a team from Kansas City. They brought in, you know, Baba and Misawa came in. But the whole show was run by Dusty and Bill Watts, basically, right? So why, as I'm watching this and I'm looking at the crowd, am I thinking, why didn't they do Ric Flair versus Jim Duggan? I think Bill Watts should have really made a play for that because, you know, Jim Duggan was the most over babyface in the Mid-South and UWF at that point. And I think having him against Flair would have created a real buzz and an interest in the Mid-South for people to come see that match in the Superdome, because I think by then New Orleans was a really downtown for Watts that had stopped really drawing big crowds after the, you know, the apex of the JYD era. And but I, you know, that just is something that ran through my mind. You're completely right about, you know, go ahead.
To that point, you're absolutely right. I mean, some of the teams that they brought in, the Italian Stallion and Coco Ware, DJ Peterson and Brett Wayne, Black Bart and the great team of Black Bart and Jimmy Garvin. Like, what, you know, what are you doing there? You got Buzz Sawyer, Rick Steiner, which is a great team.
Yeah,
and Terry Taylor, Steve Williams. You brought in the Russian team. But, you know, Dundee and Landell were there.
Yeah, I was going to say Buddy and Bill were there, who were in the middle of just a white hat run in Memphis, you know. I would have liked to have seen them, like, maybe sneak a win or two in that tournament. I think that would have been, you know, just like the way they booked it was just so routinely Dusty, you know. You have the guys you know are going to lose the first match. You could pretty much predict the outcome of every single match in this tournament, and that really took away from it. And that's why I think that, you know, I'm sure Dusty didn't want to end up in the finals like he would have against the Road Warriors, because he would have been booed against the Road Warriors, and that certainly wouldn't have worked. But I just think that instead of trying to do something that would have really made this a memorable tournament, he decided to go very ordinary. So as you said, the Sheep Herders transitioning into the Bushwhackers is really a pretty amazing story because, as you said, these guys were a really hardcore killer tag team. And, you know, that's just Butch and Luke. That's not including Jonathan Boyd, who was one of the all-time great, intense, sinister heel interviews of all time. And they had Rip Morgan with them in Memphis, who was a real good hand, who was later teamed with Jack Victory as part of the New Zealand militia. Jack Victory as the flunky outside the ring was tremendous. I thought he just did a really good
job. Absolutely.
I loved him. Yep. Jack Victory threw one of the best looking punches and yep. was a guy that he was always going to be the guy that was going to be the silent partner in a really good tag team. Cause his partner, his tag team with John Tatum in World Class was really good stuff.
Yep.
And the transition to the UWF, they got the UWF belt and, Bill Watts decided, just as they were getting over, it'd be a really good idea to give the belts to Leroy Brown and Bill Irwin, which was probably not one of Bill's better booking decisions. Let's see what else we got here. The quintuple juice in this match, because not only all four guys in the ring bleeding, then you got Victory outside the ring bleeding, and then you got a nice close up of Tommy Rogers bleeding, biting the head of Luke. Oh God, why can't I remember Luke's last name?
Butch Miller, Luke Williams.
Luke Williams, okay, biting Luke's head, and that was a nice grisly shot. Great moment when Lady Maxine appears at ringside, and I believe it's David Crockett says, "What is that thing?"
That's exactly what he said. What is that thing?
that was a really funny spot.
Oh yeah,
so, a rare bit of a diamond in the rough there from David Crockett, who is not known as one of our great ringing out or you know. Ring callers of all time, but that was a really funny moment in time. So yeah, but no, this is a great brawl, you know, for the blood and guts fans out there. This is something, and you know, you mentioned the barbed wire match that was held, I want to say a couple weeks later. I believe that wasn't a tag. Wasn't that a six man?
I think that was it. I think you're right. Yes.
And it was the Sheeps and Jack Victory against the Fantastics and I believe Terry Taylor. And that was a very solid match. You know, I have to tell you, barbed wire matches are usually, as a rule, not really good matches because the whole gimmick is staying away from the barbed wire. But that was actually one of the better barbed wire matches that you'll ever see. So anyway, are you ready to go on to our second match?
I'm actually not. So you just said something, too. So David Crockett, and I think I bring up David Crockett every week. If he's commentating on a match, I'm going to call him out. But he says something twice towards the end of this match, and he says, "You just lost $1 million." And he says it twice with this deadpan seriousness of like, come on, man. Really, David? You know, you just lost $1 million. But so here's a question I've got for you. So in this tournament, you've got the Fantastics. And the Fantastics actually beat the Fabulous Ones in the first round. You also have the Rock and Roll Express. And these were really the three teams that everybody compared. You know, whether – and again, it was Rock and Roll, Fantastics, Fabulous Ones – in your opinion, out of those three teams, which was the best working team? Not which was the most over or drew the most money. Which was the best actual working team?
Wow, that's actually a really good
question. Right? As we're into the holidays and everything's going on, and I guess we're just coming out of the holidays right now, I'm throwing out these really, really deep questions. I only say because if you look at this, you do have these weird teams in here, like I just mentioned, of like Coco Beware and the Italian Stallion, which really is pointless. At the same time, you've got the Fantastics, the Fabulous Ones, the Guerrero Brothers, the Sheepherders, the Rock and Roll Express. You've got these serious teams in here. So out of the three, which really were the big three kind of doing the rock and roll, appealing to a younger demographic and maybe even a female demographic as well, which one was the best as far as actual in-ring work? I know which one I think. That's why.
Well, I don't think, you know, like I said, that's a really good question because I don't think it's like, oh, yeah, it's obviously this team.
Right.
And as I was thinking about it, I was like, well, okay, if you're going to talk about who was the most over team, and I was getting ready to say the Fabs, but then I was like, well, no, wait a minute, because rock and roll, they were, mm-hmm. I mean, the Fabs were super, super over in Memphis, but rock and roll was over in Mid-South and huge in, you know, Crockett. But that doesn't necessarily mean who the best team was. I really think of the three, and they were all three really good teams. So this is like really like comparing an A plus to an A minus to an A kind of thing. My personal favorite is probably still Ricky and Robert.
Gotcha.
And yours?
So Ricky and Robert, the most over, drew the most money. What they did in Crockett was, to me, unbelievable. At the same time, I think the actual, you know, part of it was the missed drop kick at the end, the double drop kick, where they never connected for the Rock and Roll Express. I would say, it's a fact. I would say the Fabulous Ones. I think Steve Kern and Stan Lane. And Stan Lane was a guy that I always thought was a good complimentary worker. I never thought he was fantastic, great in the Midnight Express, everything. But for some reason, when he got with Steve Kern and the Fabulous Ones, it was elevated. Something was kicked up. And I don't know if that was Kern, because Kern, and you and I have talked about this a million times, I have said this a million times, Kern was one of the best workers in the U.S. in the second half of the 70s. And when he became part of a tag team, I do feel a little bit of that went down. At the same time, Kern was capable of anything. The guy was, to me, just off the friggin' charts. So I think he elevated Stan Lane a little bit. Again, I go back and I watch this match and I say, you know what, maybe I was wrong about the Fantastics because, again, I think I was blinded by this ass-wiggling thing. I absolutely hated that, and I still hate it. At the same time, these guys were solid workers. So it's a tough question, though, isn't it?
Yeah, no, it is. And you know, it's funny because one of the things that you and I talked about before we started taping was the way that a wrestler towards the end of his career, as he starts kind of winding out his career, whether he works as a manager, like someone like Paul Jones or Steve Kern, who then became Gator, in the WWF. A lot of times people that see those characters, they forget how good someone was earlier in their career. And people need to realize that Steve Kern nearly was made the WWF champion because it came down to him and Bob Backlund from a lot of people's account. And, you know, I don't think that Vince McMahon Sr. was going to take a guy that was really a crappy worker. And Steve Kern was anything but that at that point. He was really, really good.
Yeah, he was. He was, too. And, you know, you just mentioned the name Paul Jones as well, which Paul Jones was such a solid wrestler. And, again, people only remember him from this very short stint of being a manager and the whole Hitler thing, the Hitler's Army, when he was doing that whole thing, which was terrible. At the same time, Paul Jones as a wrestler in the 70s and even into the early 80s was one of the best, without a doubt. Yeah.
So, okay, we're going to move on. Now we're going to go to December 13th, 1981. We're going very early into the 80s. A very, very famous match in Japanese wrestling history and wrestling history altogether, because that was the night of the All Japan Tag Team Finals. We had Dory and Terry Funk versus Bruiser Brody and Jimmy Snuka. And part of the reason this match was so famous was that, let's just say, Brody and Snuka brought a guest with them to the ring. And Barry, why don't you tell the good folks about that and tell us what you think of this match?
So where did this rank in your top 100?
Well, again, you know, it wasn't in my top 20, but, you know, as I went back and watched it, wow, this is, you know, it's funny. I remember on the 605 podcast recently, there were some people that were basically kind of putting the verbal boots to Dory Funk Jr. For being a boring wrestler. And in this match, he's a lot of things, but he's not boring. This is Dory Jr. just working his ass off. Dory Jr. does a spot off the top rope, for God's sakes. How many times did you see that?
Yeah, so I think this is a good match. It's hard for me to say, is this one of the best matches of the 80s? And I'll tell you why I say that, because so many matches in All Japan at this time period were fantastic matches. They were great matches. There was definitely a huge drama. You just mentioned it, but Brody and Snuka brought out Stan Hansen. This is Stan Hansen making his debut ringside in All Japan. So there was, from a historical standpoint, this is right up there. The match, though, is great, but let's be honest, All Japan was having fantastic, mind-blowing four-star matches all the time. So my notes at this one, what I did, Snuka was so good when he was not in the WWF. You know, when he went up to the Northeast, he became this one-trick pony. Is he going to climb to the top? Will he do the super fly, you know, splash? You know, no boots, and, you know, he's going to, it just, to me, it was so formulaic when he went to the Northeast. And I realized he was over huge, but as a heel with the goatee, that was money right there. I love Snuka as a heel. It's a dream. Brody and Terry getting in the ring together, working with each other. That to me is, you know, that's not going to get, much better than that, in my opinion. There's a great spot in here where Brody whips Terry into the Hansen Lariat outside the ring, and Terry sells that thing for 10 fucking minutes. He is down, and that was one stiff-looking Lariat. And I know that you and I have heard a lot of stories about Stan Hansen specifically really laying in some of these Lariats and some of these punches, but when you look at this Lariat, and I'm going to assume this is the first one he ever threw in All Japan, That was really, really stiff. I will say I did think the ending was a little bit weak of this match, and I will let you really elaborate on that. But the ending to me was kind of flat. I don't know. There should have been a little bit more. What I really loved at the very end of this was this brawl between Hansen and Shiruta. And it really starts off where Hansen and Bob are going at it, and then it turns into a brawl between Hansen and Shiruta. And I sat there, and I just ate this up like nobody's business, because I've said this numerous times, Shiruta to me, unbelievable. One of the best workers ever in professional wrestling. My favorite wrestler that I never saw on a full-time basis, could do no wrong in my eyes. And when they started brawling, I just sat there. I didn't even blink. I was so enthralled by it.
So, a couple things. First of all, as I was getting ready to watch this match, I have to really let everyone know just what a huge deal it was for Stan Hansen to show up at the finals of the All Japan tournament. Stan Hansen had been working for New Japan, had been very successful for Inoki, and was basically next to maybe Hogan at that point was their number one gaijin and their number one American that was working over there. And so when he showed up, This was the equivalent of, I'm trying to think of, you know, if nobody knew that Bret Hart was leaving the WWF and decided to show up one day in a WCW ring, that's what the equivalent would have been, you know, because this was just something that it really was never done at that point. And what had happened was Abdullah the Butcher had jumped from All Japan to New Japan. And that sort of inspired it. And, you know, I had a chance. We talked about the dinners that I went to previously. And one of the people that we got to talk to was Stan Hansen. And I directly asked him about the fact what went on. And I'm going to read you a little excerpt from my book, Breaking Kayfabe, Dinner with the Legends of Wrestling by Jeff Bowden, available at crowbarpress.com. Anyway, here's what Stan had to say about jumping from New Japan to All Japan. My question was, what was the story behind your jump from New Japan to All Japan at the end of 1981? And Stan said, well, I got a call from Terry Funk during that year asking me how I was being treated and if I liked it in New Japan. And then he sort of asked me how much it would take to bring me back to All Japan. I didn't think much of the question other than to say that it would take a really nice offer to get me to switch because I had my spot in New Japan and going to All Japan would mean, going to All Japan would mean me having to work for a new spot all over again. I also knew I would still had 3 hours left on my New Japan contract that I fully intended to honor. So we just sort of, I'm sorry, not 3 hours, three tours, I apologize, that I fully intended to honor. So we just sort of left it at that. At the time, I was getting pressured by the New Japan front office to sign an extension. I was dealing with Hisashi Shinma, who was the president of New Japan, who I think was their president. While this was happening, I remember one night I'm in the dressing room sitting there talking to Hulk Hogan, and I hear this big commotion towards the front of the dressing room, and in walks Abdullah the Butcher with his entourage and all these press members following him. He had just jumped from All Japan over to New Japan, which was kind of a big deal. So the next time I went to talk to Shinma about extending, I point out that they had just signed Abby, which is certainly threatening my spot. And he says, quote, oh, don't worry, he's fat. He's probably going to die pretty soon, unquote. And I'm thinking, wait a minute. This is the guy you just signed and you're already bad-mouthing him? That certainly caused me to do a lot of thinking. So I said, at some point, you had to meet with Baba. Stan says, yes, I met Baba in Dallas to discuss a contract. So who knew about the fact that you were jumping, I asked. He said, it was me, Baba, and Terry Funk. That was it until before I jumped. I called Frank Brody, and I told him, I'm coming. I wanted him to know because it would certainly impact his spot also, and he ended up jumping back to New Japan a few years later and was doing a business with Inoki and then came back over to All Japan right before his death. So this was a super, super secret negotiation where only three guys knew about it until Stan Hansen walked out towards the ring that night. The pop is huge because nobody knew about it. You know, even the boys in the dressing room were probably shocked when Stan showed up. So huge deal, maybe the biggest jump of all time because of the time frame when it happened, the finals of the tournament. You know, one of the things you said was that All Japan was having such good matches at this point. You know, when I did the top 100, one of the things I prefaced before the article started was that the majority of my matches, they happen on big shows. So it's like a big stage and a big match happens because one of the things I pointed out was, you know, at 1986, in Tupelo, Mississippi, no cameras. If Eddie Gilbert and Sam Houston have a, you know, throwdown match, it's a five-star match. I'm just using it as an example. But there's 500 people there. Does that make it one of the top 100 of the 80s? It's kind of hard to quantify. So I had to take all that into consideration. So here we had a really big spot where everyone in the match, including Stan Hansen outside the ring, just came with their working shoes on, put on tremendous performances. As I'm watching this match, I'm thinking about a couple of things. First of all, Brody at this point was still really huge. His legs are just enormous. Yeah. You know, compared to later in the decade before he died, he had dropped probably a good 50 pounds because he changed his workout regimen. And he was, of course, getting older. The guys are just laying the shots in to each other. I mean, all the guys like the not just the slaps, the forearms, you know, the proverbial Dory Funk Jr. bolo like forearm, as Gordon Sully used to say. Jimmy Snuka, I thought it was pretty interesting, does a transition spot in this match that up to this point, I don't think anyone, he does the springboard press off the middle of the ropes. It was a spot that Brian Pillman made famous about 10 years after the fact. And I thought Brian Pillman might've been the first guy doing this, but here was Snuka doing it 10 years before. Then Terry does the Randy Savage flying splash elbow off the top rope to the floor. I'm like, I'd never seen Terry Funk do that. Yeah, like I said, you got Dory coming off the top rope. Stan Hansen hits Funk on the floor with what I call the clothesline of the decade because of just how important. Stan, 15 minutes into the match, was just standing there watching the match, not doing anything. Terry goes down to the floor. Brody grabs Terry from behind, and then that's when Stan basically does his debut into All Japan by throwing the clothesline, because that meant he was there. He was there for the good. And what was interesting to me, one of the complaints that a lot of people had about Dory Funk Jr. is Dory Funk Jr. was not a guy that tended to show a lot of emotion in a match. He was, you know, Gordon Sully would say, he's like an Iceman. You know, he's completely emotionless. And after Terry gets knocked down to the floor with the clothesline, Dory comes in. You remember the spot I'm talking about?
Oh, yeah.
And it is pissed off Dory, because Dory comes in and starts laying him in to Brody and Snuka, and he is showing fire like Dory Funk Jr. rarely ever shows. He opens up Brody in the ring by just laying the punches into his forehead. Meanwhile, the camera cuts away to Terry on the floor, and Terry's doing the twitching of the leg on the floor. Like you said, he's really selling the clothesline great. And then what happens is they double up on Dory. Brody ends up getting the pin on Dory. Match went about 21 minutes. After the match, there's this huge melee in the ring where, as you said, Giant Baba comes in. And, you know, there's a great spot where Giant Baba, I don't know if it was with Brody or if it was with Hansen, but it was as good as I've ever seen the Giant Baba look in a match. I mean, you know, because he's trading punches. I think it's with Hansen. He's trading punches with him, and he's selling great, and he's laying the spots in, and it was really good stuff. So then after the match is over, they go back to the dressing room. The cameras are following Hansen and Brody. Hansen had been opened up by that point. Hansen and Brody and Snuka are in their dressing room. You know, we talked one or two episodes before about the famous Jim Duggan Buzz Sawyer brawl where Cursing came into it. And what was great about this was Cursing, again, elevating a situation, because as the cameras follow Stan Hansen back, Stan Hansen is calling out for Baba for coming after him. And he's saying, "Yeah, Baba, you piece of shit." And it was just, you remember that?
Oh, yeah.
It was really good stuff. So this was a great match in a big spot coming through, and all five guys, plus Baba and Saruta, as you said, at the end. So, geez, we're talking seven guys that really came with their working shoes on, put on a great show. Big spot, big match, and I loved it.
Yeah, I'll tell you, Dory's punches too. So he throws the bolo, like, you know, the forearm uppercut smash, but he also was throwing these punches that were the best punches I've ever seen Dory throw. And he wasn't really a guy known. I saw plenty of Dory growing up in Florida. Dory wasn't really known for throwing a lot of punches, and he was just laying in on Brody's forehead, and they looked great.
Yeah, this was some seriously good stuff. This is about everything you want from that time period from a tag match. You know, you had Snuka flying, Dory and Terry, again, doing spots off the top rope. Wow, that was just, and this wasn't crazy, Terry's middle-aged crazy Terry Funk. This is a serious working Terry, no goofy comedy spots. This was just a ass-kicking match, and as good a brawl with, I think, Double Juice going back to the dressing room, cursing up a storm, just seriously good stuff.
Yeah, too, and it's, you know, it is funny. I think Terry had only retired about 12 times prior to this match, and of course, 47 times after. But you're right, too. They were doing stuff, and when you get, and I mentioned this quickly, too, when you get Brody and Terry in the ring together, and they're working with each other, you can hear the crowd, because this is two of the most revered guys ever in Japan. So even the crowd is, oh, you know, and I'm sitting here, and I'm marking out watching it as well. So it's an excellent match. Again, this is coming from a time period in Japan where most of the main events were just, you know, through the roof and just excellent. But I agree. Having Hansen there really just set this off the bar.
Well, and, you know, there's one spot that I forgot. You know, one of the things Brody was criticized for, I think, later in his career was he was a guy that did not give much to anybody. And in this match, there's a sequence where he and Terry are throwing punches at one another. And I mean, they're just laying them in. And then Brody begins to slowly retreat, but he does it in a way that doesn't lessen him, and it elevates Terry's punches. And it was a really effective sequence.
Yeah, I agree with you. Yep.
Yeah, so, okay. Now we're going to go to the last match we're going to talk about from the top 100. This match, these three matches, by the way, were not in my top 20. We skipped my top 20 this week because this last match we're going to talk about, I had not seen this match in at least 10 or 15 years, and I forgot how much fun this match could be and how much it was. We're going to the 7th of November, 1986 in Korakuen Hall in Tokyo. Hair versus hair rematch, Chigusa Nagoya versus Dump Masamoto. And, you know, I talked about how some matches, you know, big matches. That's what I mentioned before. And I discussed the Kerry Von Erich versus Ric Flair match from Christmas night of 82. How part of what made the greatness of that match was the spectacle involving the turn of Michael Hayes and Terry Gordy, and how that elevated that match into top 100 status. What was a good match, maybe even a very good match, but all the spectacle around it elevated it into a great match. Here, in my opinion, and I'm going to throw it to you in a second, Barry, the spectacle surrounding both performers in this match is really what took what's basically a very good to really good brawl and elevated it into a top 100 of the decade. Barry, tell us what you thought about this match.
Yeah, well, and you're spot on with that comment too. So there's not actually, as a match, I don't think there's much really happening. I mean, Chigusa doesn't really have much of an offense going up against Dump, which is definitely played up throughout the match. But other than doing roll-ups, I don't really think she really does a whole lot. It's the spectacle of this match. This is, the circus has come to town. And even with the entrances, that entrance from Dump, I mean, both entrances are great, but when Dump comes in, she's got her entourage there, and they're carrying the flags, and she's dressed up. Her and Chigusa both have swords coming into the ring. They've got swords? Holy shit. I just think this is such a good match, and it's not the in-ring work. It's the drama. It's the fact that there are people crying in the audience, in the crowd. It's, you know, you look next to the crowd and there's old men wearing suits next to young girls who are in tears, next to middle-aged, what I'm assuming are housewives. So it's this demographic that just scans and runs all up along and down the board, and people are in tears in watching this match, and there's such a drama. And when the crowd starts chanting and they go, Chigusa, Chigusa, and I don't know how many people you've gotten there, 10,000, what is Korakuen see?
No, but, actually, you know, Korakuen's maybe 2,500 people.
Okay, so it's a smaller.
Which, yeah, it's a small
venue. I think
it
adds to it then. Okay, gotcha. But, you know, people are just chanting her name, and it's literally everybody in the building that's doing it. So a couple of notes when I look at this match, and this is a match I'm going to tell you right off the bat. This is one you're going to want to get on YouTube, Daily Motion. Google it, find it, watch it. And this is one you can show somebody who's not a wrestling fan, and I say that because I showed my wife this match. My wife is not a wrestling fan. Hard to believe, considering that I cram it down her throat 24/7 for the last 25 years. But to that end, this is a match that I think anybody could watch because it transcends wrestling. This is, when I said the circus comes to town, this is the circus coming to town. I do find it interesting. Chigusa, I'll never be able to pronounce this correctly. She plays the most homogenized baby face of all time. And she comes out, she looks innocent, she looks, it's almost childlike in the way that she portrays herself, and she tries to shake hands with Dump, and Dump's gimmick at that point is spitting water in the faces of all of her opponents, which is, you know, 20 years before Triple H ever attempted this. So I really got a kick out of that. You know, why, considering the heat between them, would Chigusa want to go up to her and try to shake her hand? That I don't know. But then there's this inexplicable thing where Dump just attacks the referee. And she hits the referee with a chain. This guy blades and hits a gusher. He wraps a towel around his head and goes on like nothing ever happened, like business as usual. She continues to either beat the crap out of him numerous times, taking shots at him throughout the match, but at the same time, he'll like push her from the ropes, like, and start to do a count. Like, I don't understand the logic in that whatsoever. I think, and I want to make sure that I'm phrasing this correctly. In this match, we're seeing arguably two of the greatest heel and baby faces ever, because they both, Dump as a heel maybe one of the greatest of all time. And she'll never be ranked, you know, next to like the Bull Currys and the King Curtises and or Killer Carl Coxes, people that are considered as the great heels, which is to me is a travesty because you watch her and everything she does in that match is a heel. Every little facial movement, everything she does. And I just said about Chigusa, she's as white, you know, as Japanese, but she's a baby face. She is the typical prototype baby face. And there's a scene in here too, one spot where Dump is actually choking Chigusa with a sword. You know that spot I'm talking about?
Oh, yeah. No, I made a
mention. Oh, my God. She's got her up against the ring rope. She's got the sword, and she's choking her with a frickin' sword. It's unbelievable. Then she grabs a fork, and she starts to stab her with a fork. And Chigusa, I'm guessing, does the blade job on her chin? Like, you know, holy cow. So, to me, this is... Look, we've been doing this show now for 2 or 3 months, and we've recommended a lot of matches. I have said, you know, I'm a positive guy, and I basically put over almost every – I believe in it, but I put almost over everything that we do because, A, I'm a fan. At the end of the day, I'm a fan. I'll also call it as I see it. This is the match you want to see. This is not a great technical match. I don't think Chigusa does anything other than a roll-up in this match. At the same time, you will not believe what you're seeing.
Yeah, this is just a spectacle is the only word to properly use to describe this match because, you know, it's interesting because at this time there was nothing in the United States or North America that was anywhere close to this in women's wrestling. I have said many times I am not a fan of the WWE right now. It just is a product does not interest me whatsoever. I know they've supposedly really elevated the women's division and they're doing very good work. But I sit there and watch this and I'm like, how is anything that the WWE is doing with their women's division? And I fully admit I don't watch it, but I can't imagine anything they're doing with Charlotte Flair or any of these other women anywhere close to this. Because this is, I was trying to quantify for people that aren't fans of Japanese wrestling or Japanese women's wrestling. This is basically the equivalent of Ricky Morton in his prime going against Vader. You know, I mean,
that's a great analogy.
And the way that if you can imagine like Ricky Morton in 85 or 86 going against Vader of like, I don't know what, like, when did he really, it was like 93, 94 in WCW. Try to imagine those two forces colliding and what the match would have been like. It would have been Vader essentially just destroying Ricky Morton. Ricky Morton having the fans in tears because he's so near death. That's what this match was like. Now, let me talk about a few of the notes that I made on the match. This was a rematch. They had a 1985 hair versus hair match where Chigusa lost. So this was Chigusa's big chance to get her revenge on Dump and get Dump's head shaved. So Chigusa comes out. She's dead serious. Dump comes out. This is part of the spectacle. She's wearing she has a faux hawk, if you will, that's rainbow colored. It's just her face is painted completely. This is not like Road Warrior face paint or Ultimate Warrior. She's got paint all over her face. And she comes out. She's wearing a shirt that says heavy metal. She's got the boots that say Dump on it. It's just such a visual spectacle. I really hope that our producer, the great Brian Lass, can find this picture out there somewhere on the internet or Google just so people can see what Dump looked like walking towards the ring. Dump walked towards the ring as the most hated person in the building. You know, you were talking about Dump won't be comparable to guys like Bull Curry and King Curtis. I'm thinking – in the history of the wrestling, no, you're absolutely right. In the history of the wrestling business, the only person for her run in All Japan Women that I could compare her to as a heel might have been the Sheik in Detroit, because that's how incredibly over she was. That's the specter of evil that she portrayed to those fans. She came into that arena And every person in that arena was afraid of her, not just the little girls. I was sitting here as you were talking about her. I'm trying to think, it would be the equivalent of like Donald Trump walking into the Democratic convention or Hillary walking into the Republican convention, the kind of heat that Dump had. So that's me trying to stay apolitical, by the way. So as you said,
and to touch on that, your comparison of Dump, All Japan Women, Sheik, and Detroit territory is 100% correct, because the entire territory was built around him being this hated heel. It's the same thing here. This is her domain by far.
And she comes in, she does a spot where she spits water on Chigusa, as Barry said. Then she grabs the referee, opens up the referee. The crowd is on their feet literally the entire match. The match ends up going about 16, 17 minutes, something like that. She does the pencil attack, much like the Sheik. She opens Chigusa up. There's a great spot where the camera zooms in and the referee is admonishing her, and she gives this smile as Chigusa. She's got Chigusa by the head and she's opening her up with the pen, and she just smiles at the referee, and it's so sinister and so evil looking. But you know what's interesting? For as much as you talked about how Chigusa was really doing nothing more than roll-ups and that kind of thing, there's a great wrestling spot, believe it or not, in the midst of all this. Chigusa goes to roll up Dump. Dump kicks out of it, but as she kicks out, I don't know if you saw this, in the same sequence, as she's kicking out, she grapevines Chigusa's leg. And she puts her in a leg scissors. And I'm like going, where the hell did that come from? So, and then, let's see, she chokes her with a fork, or with a sword, as you said. There's this great spot where she throws Chigusa to the floor. The crowd is chanting, Chigusa, Chigusa, just going nuts. And right in front of, right behind where they're at, excuse me, in the midst of this, she's pounding on Chigusa, and there's a guy standing there. And in the midst of all this, the guy suddenly pulls out a cigarette and lights up the cigarette.
Yes.
And it's so funny. Every girl in the promotion is at ringside for this match. You had your Devil Masamis, Bull Nakano, all your big baby faces, all your, you know, the jumping bomb angels were all down there. Chigusa is opened up, and you know, we've talked over the course of our show here, the original all-time bloodletting in a match was Don Carnotal. Then we went to Sergeant Slaughter in the Patterson match. The way that Chigusa bleeds in this match, I think, has out-slaughtered Sergeant Slaughter, because she is bleeding like the proverbial stuck pig. I mean, it's just, and you know, at the end of the match, she's hanging on for dear life, and she had to be concussed at some point in this match, because here at the very end, you think there's nothing more that Dump Masamoto can do to Chigusa. She brings out the steel trash cans and just starts laying in the shots with the trash cans, and you're like, Chigusa's dead. The finish is,
you know why Chigusa, it works also too.
Why
so
is that?
Chigusa looks like a 14-year-old girl. So you've got this 14-year-old girl that's getting the shit beaten out of her, and she's covered in blood. It's so dramatic. And then they cut to the crowd, and you look at these other little girls in the arena. They're just crying their eyes out as their hero's getting destroyed.
The one, as you said, the one disappointing part of this match is the finish kind of – it comes out of nowhere, and it seems a little weak, quite frankly. And maybe it had to do with the fact that Chigusa was legitimately – had lost so much blood that maybe she was weak. Dump, after the match is over, somehow, you know, you've got everything. You had the fork, the sword, the trash cans. Somewhere, the kendo stick comes out, and she just starts laying the wood to the referee. Spits water again. She starts heading to the back. I'm not going to get my hair cut. She starts going to the back. There's a great moment where, as she's going to the back, there is a balcony. And she turns back to the ring. She's defiant. She's like not going along with the stipulations of this match. And suddenly she starts getting showered with whatever it is, soda, beer, I'm not sure. And she's standing there and she turns and looks, and she doesn't start, you know, verbally interacting with the crowd. She stands there and just holds her, just like stands defiant. And it's such an epic heel moment, because it's exactly what she should have done. Like, she's unbowed, and then she ends up coming back to the ring on her own. Doesn't have to get dragged back, which I think is very effective. She sits in the ring, and you can, you know, without speaking Japanese, you know what she's saying is, here I am, go ahead, cut my damn hair. And here she is, she's getting her hair cut. She gets the sort of the Jerry Lawler crew cut. She doesn't go for the full head shave. She gets up, She starts throwing the challenges immediately at Lioness Asuka, who's in the ring, basically propping up Chigusa. Before, when she was starting to walk back to the dressing room, there's a great spot where Chigusa's got the towel wrapped around her head. She's laying against the rope because she can't stand, and she's calling out to her, you know, to get back and take your medicine. I took it. You come back and take it. It's your turn now. That's part of what led to Dump coming back to the ring. So here's one of the really funny spots that kind of struck me as unusual. So after the match is over, Dump has left the ring with her entourage. The crowd is standing there. Chigusa's in the ring with Lioness and Devil Masami. And Chigusa suddenly walks over to the referee and puts her arms around the referee. And the referee hugs her back. You know, like, hey, we both did this. We both defeated the evil Dump Matsumoto. So
who was the referee? He looks Hispanic.
He was not. There was a referee. Yeah, he didn't look Asian. There was a guy that worked that was a heel referee. His name was I believe Shiro Abe was his name. He was actually one of the guys that gave the haircut. So it was not the normal referee that was assigned to Chigusa's matches, because a lot of times they had this heel referee. They were actually the first person to do the heel referee gimmick before the WWF did the bit with Danny Davis as the heel referee.
So Shiro Abe is the guy in the kind of Saturday Night Live, Saturday Night Fever blue suit giving Dump the haircut?
No. He's the other guy that's doing it. The ring announcer is the guy
Yeah. But, gotcha. Okay, yeah.
So, all right. So we done with that one?
I think so, but I got to recommend it. If you're listening to us, and you know, the response to the show has just been great over the last few weeks. I've been getting messages every day, people telling that they love what we're talking about, they love what we're doing. This is the match that Jeff and I are saying, run, Google it, find it on YouTube, wherever it is, you got to see it.
Yeah, good stuff. So, want to do a little housekeeping here. A couple episodes back, I started discussing my top 21 memories of the 1980s. Was also an article that I wrote for the 1989 Observer Yearbook. I did a lot of work for the Observer Yearbook that year. I got to be honest with you, Barry.
And you made a lot of money.
Well, of course, I was well compensated. Maybe. So I did the top 21. We talked about numbers 11 through 21. So today, just to finish up, we're going to throw out my top 10 memories, talk about them, how much fun they were. Number 10, Jim Cornette throws a birthday party for his dog Fifi. I wrote, this skit was done on a small Georgia circuit in 1983. That was after the Georgia and Tennessee crew. They brought in Dundee to be the booker of this small promotion. I believe it was based in Chattanooga. Consequently, very few people have seen it, and it's possibly the funniest skit of the decade. Cornette and his dynasty, which included such wrestling luminaries as Jerry Novak, the French Angel Frank Morel, Norman Frederick Charles III, and Carl Fergie, come out after buying time on the show with party hats, confetti, noisemakers, and a cake, and they throw a birthday party for a poodle. Barry, have you ever seen this?
I have. So I saw when it originally aired, and I don't know if it was – I don't know where I saw it. I don't know if it was TBS or if they were airing it in syndication. I was living down in North Miami Beach, Florida at that time, so I saw it. What I remember most about this, and I really liked it, Jim was still wearing the sailor's cap or the yachtsman cap at the time, was having known Jim from the WFIA days, this was the first chance that I got to see him actually manage and be a TV personality. So I was super excited and I was super proud knowing what a passionate fan he had been that he's actually made it in the business. So I thought it was great. You know, this to me was old school. Whenever you do the birthday cake or anything, you know, a birthday party for a dog, you know something's going to happen. I love this.
Yeah, and this was, by the way, this was Jim Cornette between his Memphis run and Mid-South. He had not gone to Mid-South yet. So,
right.
Number 9, Bill Mercer visits Jimmy Garvin's house. How do we know it's Jimmy Garvin's house? Because Bill Mercer told us so. The best part was Garvin coming out to the door wearing nothing but a towel, and Precious is wearing nothing but a shirt. And Garvin says, Bill Mercer, I can't believe you came to my house.
Yeah, I like this too. And I saw this when this aired. We used to get it, WCCW World Class. We would get it like 11 o'clock at night on a Saturday night. Do you remember that in the 80s?
Yeah, I believe it was Channel 33.
I think it was Channel 33. Good memory, Jeff. See, sobriety does you well, my friend.
You know.
Yeah, well, maybe. Okay, but in any case, I remember seeing this was when it originally aired, and I remember thinking, this is so much fun. And this was the kind of stuff, too, that, you know, in later years when the WWF would do it, when they did all the comedy stuff, I would always flip the channel. But when you saw something like this appearing on World Class, which didn't do a lot of this, it kind of made you take notice. So, yeah, I love this as well.
Well, and it's funny you say that because my next two memories were both from World Class in this time period. Number eight was the Sunshine press conference where she discusses her split with Jimmy Garvin. You know, Jimmy, I don't know why you did this to me. It was something that was so revolutionary because no one had done this up to this point. And in concert with that, my number seven was the Valet for the Day with Jimmy Garvin and Sunshine working for David Von Erich, which this is hilarious because you got Jimmy Garvin and Sunshine washing David Von Erich's dog, which is just...
Yeah, they're washing the dog, and I remember that too, and Jimmy's complaining the whole time, and Precious is complaining. That was awesome. That again, right. This was something that you normally didn't see, and so for a promotion to do this, it really made you, you know, pay attention to it, and I got a huge chuckle out of it. I loved it.
I think he had Sunshine like digging post holes too. It was really funny stuff.
He did, exactly.
So
that was great.
Number six, Jimmy Snuka perched on top of the cage, leaps onto Bob Backlund and misses.
Iconic moment. Is it? It is. It's a moment. It's 10 seconds. It's an iconic moment. We all know it. Everybody out there is aware of it. Definitely deserves to be on your list.
Yeah. Number five was mentioned previously in one of our episodes, Terry Gordy slamming the cage door into Kerry Von Erich's head to set up the Freebird Von Erich feud. Christmas night, 1982, as we discussed, that feud went 3-4 years because of one single spot. That's certainly an example of a great angle making money for everybody. Number four, wow, this is such a fun and great unintended moment. I'll read you what I wrote. The classic first and last interview by Ernie Holmes, who was a former lineman for the Pittsburgh Steelers, a Steel Curtain defense, a great lineman who had a very short-lived wrestling career, and I mean like 1 week long. Gordon Solie asked Holmes about guys who he had manhandled during his career. Holmes immediately responded with the name Gene Upshaw, then got tongue-tied and couldn't remember the name of the other player that he was one to think of. Holmes then described the player, couldn't still remember his name, and Solie looked at him and says, "Hey, yeah, the name's on the tip of my tongue also."
Yeah, I saw this years later on videotape. Yeah, that was kind of odd. Ernie, how long was Ernie there? Maybe 3 weeks, 2 weeks?
If that. I was going to say he was with Michael Hayes, but that was Otis Sistrunk. Apparently, Georgia, they like to bring in a former NFL lineman for very short runs. My number three, during a strength demonstration on TBS, Ken Patera, Jimmy Snuka are Jimmy Snuka and Terry Gordy are about to smash two cement blocks with a sledgehammer. They do the gimmick with the sledgehammer onto Ken Patera to show how strong Ken Patera is. Terry Gordy grabs the mic from Gordon Solie and says, "I want to recommend to all you kids out there to try this with your buddies." And Gordon is completely horrified by the fact that Terry Gordy said it was really funny. My number two moment, last two are both Georgia. Ole Anderson turns on Dusty Rhodes in the steel cage in the Omni in Atlanta. Barry, why don't you share some memories of that? Because you were there that night, if I'm not mistaken.
I was there. Lederberg was there. Kurt Brown was there. It was really all part of the WFIA convention, and it was a big deal. And it was one of these things, and Lederberg was absolutely correct. He turns to us during the match and said, "How cool would this be if everybody turned on Dusty and attacked him in the cage?" And that was basically his partner turns on him, the referee turns on him. So it would be Ole and Koloff. They were facing the Assassins. So this was a moment when it was, I didn't see it coming. I wasn't that bright, still not that bright, but Lederberg figured it out. There were grown men in tears at the end of this match. So absolutely huge, probably the second greatest turn I've ever seen live.
Oh, please throw us out number one.
Okay, I was waiting for you to ask. I didn't want to. Ernie Ladd turns on Dusty Rhodes. There's Dusty again. Miami Beach, 1977. A full-scale riot almost breaks out. So I would say it's a small-scale riot breaks out. It was a big deal back then.
Wow. So, okay, my number one memory for the 1980s is a great, great angle that I don't think ended up making a lot of money for the territory because the territory was sort of down at that point, Atlanta. But the day that Terry Gordy piledrived Ted DiBiase five times in the studios. And here's a great story because I had dinner with Ted DiBiase and he was talking to me about this angle. So the Freebirds gang up on DiBiase. Terry Gordy famously piledrives him on the cement floor. Ted DiBiase is selling it and Gordon Solie is selling it like DiBiase is basically dead on the floor. They actually checked Ted DiBiase into a hospital in Atlanta. And they do a video. I believe Steve Kern and Terry Taylor went to the hospital to visit him. I know Steve Kern. Yeah, Steve Kern was definitely one of them. And they're talking to Ted. Ted, how you feeling? Ted's got the neck brace on. Steve, I just want to let everybody know that I'm going to get out of this. You know, one of those kind of interviews. And it was very well done. But because they had legitimately checked him into the hospital and they did not want all these wrestling fans calling the hospital, they told Ted DiBiase, Ted, give us the name of people that you want to have us let the calls through. And he's given, you know, his wife and, you know, different family members if they want to call him just so they know that it's all part of a work. So apparently the one name that he did not bother to give him was Jim Barnett. And Jim Barnett was running Championship Wrestling for Florida. So Jim Barnett could not get through to Ted DiBiase. And Jim Barnett was none too thrilled about that. Now, mind you, the other part about this that makes it compelling and interesting that Ted DiBiase told me was this was in a time period when Ted DiBiase was considered as one of the two guys, actually three, because it was DiBiase, Flair, and Dusty were going to be the big trifecta that were going to carry the NWA belt probably for the next 5 years. And that whole sequence where he forgot about Barnett, then apparently there was a story where he went up to St. Louis to work a card to the Keel, and Sam Muchnick very innocuously came up and said, Ted, how's things going down there? And Ted apparently turned to Sam Muchnick and goes, well, Sam, if you must know, it's the shits because we're not drawing anybody. And Sam happened to mention that to Jim Barnett, so that was strike two. And Ted DiBiase never ended up becoming an NWA world champion, but he ended up going to Mid-South, had a tremendous run for Bill Watts. Okay, so those are the end of my memories. Fun times. Certainly, if you Google or YouTube any of those, great memories to find. Now, Barry, it's time for us to go to our worst Seinfeld episodes. As we said, Seinfeld, such an iconic show, something that Barry and I use in everyday conversation with, you know, not just with one another, but to family and friends. We'll throw out a Seinfeld reference. But as we said, even Seinfeld had some episodes that, quite frankly, weren't very good. That still means they were better than most of the shows that were out there. But for Seinfeld, which had set the bar so high, these are the ones that we feel did not muster up, shall we say. Now, we're going to go top five because, quite frankly, top 10 lists with both of us tend to run a little long. And we end up blowing out our voices. So we're going to keep this to a top five. Only special editions of Breaking Kayfabe get the top 10 list, people. Don't be getting greedy on me. So we're going to go top five worst Seinfeld episodes. So, Barry, why don't you start us off with your fifth worst Seinfeld episode?
So number five for me, The Doll, season 7, episode 16. It's where George is freaking out because he finds out that Susan has a doll that is identical to his mother. So, you know, there are certain things that I like about this episode, and then I'll tell you exactly what I don't like about it. But I like the doll. It's super fucking creepy. If you remember this at all, this is a doll made of Estelle Harris, who played George's mother. And the maestro is also in this episode, and I always liked the maestro. That was Mark Metcalf, who was also really famous from Animal House. So, pardon me. That's what I like.
Is
what
that
I don't
your
like
pledge,
about.
Ben?
Exactly. Exactly. That's the guy. That's the guy that was on the horse. And yes, yeah, so I like him a lot. I was happy to see that somebody that I felt was had such a great character in Animal House. Animal House was such an iconic movie for the late 70s. I mean, it was 1979 or 1980 when it came out. And a lot of those guys, especially, you know, like this guy, like Niedermeyer, they really didn't do a whole lot immediately following. He did. He became the maestro. He was also in the Twisted Sister video or a couple of their videos. You know, you make me. But in any case, what I don't like about this episode is Kathy Griffin. So I am not a Kathy Griffin fan. She is one of those people that she annoys me. I can't put my finger on it. I don't find her funny. There's definitely a shrill voice. And to me, she so heavily detracts from this episode. Had it been somebody else playing the character of the female comedian, Sally Weaver, I would have been fine. Again, the doll is great. The maestro is great. Kathy Griffin, to me, is an immediate channel changer.
Yeah, no, that was not a great episode. A while back, I actually went and saw Kathy Griffin in concert, and I thought she was very funny. Not such a big fan of her now. She just kind of never evolved from what she was doing. You know, she's like Andrew Dice Clay for women. You know, Andrew Dice Clay was very funny for a while, I thought. And then he just never evolved as a comedian. And, you know, if you're going to stay the same, you're just going to fall by the wayside. And that's what she kind of did, in my opinion.
Yeah, I never really thought she was funny. Take out a lot of the political, which I could care less about. That's not it at all. She's just not funny. And there is a certain shrillness to her voice that when I hear it, it's almost like nails on a chalkboard for me. But we did talk about Andrew Dice Clay. I don't know, a couple of months back, we talked about a Showtime television show called Dice, and he has evolved. So a guy that had to hit rock bottom and start to climb back up in order to change, to evolve, I recommended that. And I think what the episode was, three TV shows that we would recommend that maybe people aren't watching. I would recommend that show. Yeah.
Yeah. So, okay, my number five is The Chicken Roaster. The Chicken Roaster, it revolves around a Kenny Rogers chicken restaurant moving in next door to Jerry's apartment, Jerry and Kramer's apartment. Jerry and Kramer end up switching their apartment. And to me, it's just the only part of this episode that I thought was really funny. There was an interchange between Jerry Seinfeld and Newman, where he confronts him about the fact that he has some broccoli, and he thinks it, and he says, hold on. Broccoli, Newman, you wouldn't eat broccoli if it was deep fried in chocolate sauce. Newman says, I love broccoli. It's good for you. Really? Then maybe you'd like to have a piece. So he hands him a piece of broccoli, and Newman eats it, and he starts eating. He spits it. He's a vile weed.
So I think that line is great, and that's an iconic line because I've actually used that with my kids. I've actually said exactly, not about broccoli, but maybe it's cauliflower or some other vegetable.
I thought you were going to talk about some other vile weed that you maybe didn't want to admit on the podcast.
Exactly. I'll tell you what I do like about this episode. And you're right, this is not one of the stronger, but I like the fact that the sign from Kenny Rogers Roasters is flashing in their eyes all night. And anybody that's ever lived in an apartment in New York, you have to put up with lights in your eyes. I lived on an apartment 20 years ago with my wife, and it was on the old proverbial 33rd and 3rd, and there was a fire station right across the street, and we would hear sirens 24 hours a day. So I like the fact that they're doing that. The lights are flashing in the eyes, but to that end, you're right. This is not one of the stronger episodes.
Okay, number four.
Number four for me is The Visa, Season 4, Episode 15. I could tell you the pros and cons, and then I'll describe a little bit. For me, it's Babu Bhatt. I was never a fan of having this stereotypical Indian character with this deep Indian voice. It just didn't work. But Babu was a guy, you know, Jerry had driven him into bankruptcy before when he was trying to get him to change the menu at his restaurant. Jerry goes away, comes back after a couple of weeks, and Babu's working at the cafe and also living right near Jerry. Turns out that that in Jerry's mail was Babu's visa application, and because he had been out of town, never gave it to him, so they have to get a lawyer. I just don't find it funny. For whatever it is, there is kind of a Curb Your Enthusiasm, if it can go wrong, it will go wrong kind of mentality with this. At the same time, it's not funny. What I did think was funny was Kramer. So Kramer goes off to a fantasy camp, and George has this great line. He goes, Kramer goes to a fantasy camp. His whole life is a fantasy camp. People should plunk down $2,000 to live like him for a week. Do nothing, fall ass backwards into money, mooch food off your neighbors, and have sex without dating. That's a fantasy camp. And then Kramer comes back from this baseball fantasy camp where apparently he's punched Mickey Mantle in the mouth and knocked him unconscious.
And Pepitone was crowding the plate, wasn't he?
He was, exactly. So that I like. Take out Babu Bhatt again. I hate that character. Absolutely can find nothing funny about it. I would have liked the episode.
I love the part where he says, well, I hit Joe Pepitone. You hit Joe Pepitone? He was crowding the plate. I own that plate, mister. Yeah, that was...
Yep, it was the brush back. That's right.
Yeah, that was very funny. So my number four is The Blood. The Blood is bad to me for a lot of reasons. Number one, you know, the way you described Babu Bhatt as just somebody you did not find funny, for me, it's the whole Izzy Mandelbaum thing. The old guy that's the exercise, the trainer, personal trainer. I just thought this whole episode fell so flat. There's the whole thing, you know, with him trying to get Jerry to work out, where then he throws his back out, then his father throws his back out. And, you know, it just, to me, was very tiring. And I just, not good. That's the way, this is a rare, just complete miss from Seinfeld to me.
Mandelbaum. I love Lloyd Bridges. I have a lot of respect. Seahawk was one of my favorite TV shows when I was growing up as a kid watching.
Oh, I love Lloyd too. I just didn't like him in this role.
This episode sucks, Jeff. There's no beating around the bush. There was nothing. It did not work. It was too cartoonish. As cartoonish as Seinfeld could be, this was just way too over the top for me. I agree with you.
So, number three.
Number three for me, The Fatigue, season 8, episode 6. If you notice, a lot of the episodes that I don't like were in the later years. I did like the earlier stuff. I hear a criticism often that the earlier stuff is dated, possibly. At the same time, I still laugh at it. I didn't like this, and I think it's a couple of reasons I didn't like it. I did not like the character that – so The Fatigues is basically – and there's a couple of different stories in here, and there's one side story that I like, but there's this guy, Eddie Sherman, that's working for Jay Peterman. Elaine has to fire him and is scared of him, so she doesn't fire him and instead promotes him. And this entire thing backfires because all of these other employees quit because he gets promoted over them. And then Elaine, who's deathly afraid of this guy, who's kind of a psycho, has to work on a project with him. And he comes up with this clothing for the Peterman catalog, and it's called The Fatigues. I hated that. I didn't think this character worked. I didn't think there was anything funny about that storyline. I didn't like it. The other aspect of this episode is Jerry's new girlfriend is mentoring Jerry's new girlfriend's mentor is dating Banya. And I felt Banya in small doses worked. But there was way too much Banya in this episode, so I didn't like that. The little side story that I do like of this episode, which I think was great, is where Frank is cooking for the Jewish singles. And he tells this story of when he cooked back in the army and he got everybody sick and everybody's vomiting. I thought that was really funny. But overall, because of the Elaine story and too much Banya, this episode doesn't work for me.
Yeah, you know, the stuff with Frank when he remembered his time in Korea, there was another episode where he meets the girl that he dated in Korea, but he had to break up with her because he wouldn't take his shoes off when he went into her house because he had a foot odor problem. That stuff
between
was gold.
Me and you, I got a foot odor problem. Exactly. Yeah, that's gold.
Gold. That's gold, Jerry. Gold. You beat me to the punch. So my number three is The English Patient. Again, we had the Mandelbaums. There's that recurring theme of how much I hated that character. And the whole show is about the fact that the English Patient is garnering all these Academy Awards and it's so well thought of, and they really don't want to go see the movie. And that just seemed like it was the whole basis of the episode. Not a fan.
Yeah, I'm not a fan either. So again, we get to the Mandelbaums, and again, they can bring down, and I feel so bad saying that because I love Lloyd Bridges.
Yeah.
Jeff Bridges, one of my favorite actors. So why couldn't we have made this work? But it didn't work, and you're 100% right. This is a weak episode. And I remember Elaine's got a comment about the English Patient. Just get out of the desert, something like that. But it doesn't work. It's just not one of the better episodes. To your point, as you said earlier, still better than probably 90% of what else is on television. From a Seinfeld rating, it doesn't work.
Yeah. Okay, give me your number two.
And we're keeping count again. I'm so proud that after
I almost forgot the last one, but I'm there.
You did. You did. You went number three. Yeah, there was a little hesitation there, but yeah. So, for, again, I am back to season eight. And I'm going to assume that I really hated season eight. Season eight, episode two, The Soulmate, don't like it. It's where Jerry and George both, and Kramer, Jerry and Kramer are kind of having the hots for the same girl. Her name is Pam. George believes that the foundation lawyer thinks that he might have killed Susan. I hated the foundation aspect of it. There was nothing funny about that. Just didn't like it. And that's also the one where George puts a tape recorder in the briefcase so he could tape the conversation to see if they really think that he did kill Susan, which they did. And then Elaine's dating this guy, Kevin, and they're talking about getting, you know, a vasectomy, and he gets a vasectomy to show how committed he is, that he doesn't want to have children. This episode doesn't work. If there's a pro to this, the girl that plays Pam is an actress named Kim Myers, who was also in the second Nightmare on Elm Street movie, Freddy's Revenge. And she did a bunch of other stuff, Law and Orders and a bunch of other TV shows. And she's a fairly fetching young woman. So I did like her, but the whole storyline just doesn't work. There is one scene that I think is really funny, and it's right out of the movie Roxanne or Cyrano de Bergerac, if you remember the movie Roxanne with Steve Martin.
Sure.
And so Newman is standing behind a bunch of bookcases, and he's feeding Kramer a bunch of lines to say to Pam, and she's really touched by what he's saying, and he's talking about the way her hair smells, it's Pantene, and then he starts reading off some poetry, and then she mentions something about junk mail, and Newman starts going on a rant, and then Kramer is saying it, and it just becomes really funny. Other than that, I hated this episode.
Yeah, my number, I completely agree with you, but you know, it was funny, you said Banya could be good in small doses. I always found that Newman in The Small Doses was absolutely brilliant, a brilliant character. But if you got too much of him, it kind of watered the character down. And I agree that there was a period, I think it was like a two-season run, where Larry David was no longer part of the writing team. And you could really see that, because I think it really suffered, the show in general suffered. My number two, The Little Jerry. There is nothing that amuses me about animals fighting. And this episode was about cockfighting. It was a funny bit in the show about Jerry supposedly had written a bad check, and the guy put Jerry's check on the wall to show everyone that Jerry Seinfeld had written a bad check to him. But the stuff about, you know, little Jerry, and, you know, they want him to, they put little gloves so he could box and stuff. No, I didn't like it. Wasn't a big fan. You?
No, it sucked. Yeah, we can be honest. It really did suck, too. And there was, again, so if you say to people, Little Jerry, other than the fact that the rooster was named Little Jerry, which is kind of funny, there's nothing else funny about this episode. And if you ask people, tell me about Little Jerry, all they're going to say is, yeah, the rooster was named Little Jerry. They can't tell you anything else about this episode because it sucked.
Yeah. So, okay, drum roll, please. Your number one most hated Seinfeld episode.
Yeah, so I am going to quantify this by saying that in reality, and Jeff and I, it was a handshake long distance, but we said we are not going to include the finale as our top five, or our bottom five in this case. So I have to stick with that. We did shake on this, even if it was through the phone. But at the same time, I absolutely hated the finale. I do want to say that I hated the finale. The finale was not funny. The finale was too long, first off. You know, these shows should only be 30 minutes. And I think the mistake in the finale, A, there is a lot of Babu Bot, so right there I'm already going to be, you know, biased against it, was that and Larry David did this in Curb Your Enthusiasm this year, and the similarities and comparisons between it is he crammed an entire seasons, you know, eight or nine seasons into one episode. Every character had to come back. Everybody had to get their spot. And you were shoving too much down our throats, and it wasn't funny. And this year, when Curb Your Enthusiasm came back, the first episode, which was not funny, was we had to bring back every character, and we had to give everybody 3 minutes just to kind of showcase themselves. And it didn't work. So with that being said, I had to pick another episode. And it was very, very hard for me to come up with another episode. So, man. And this is tough. This is tough for me because I almost don't know in which direction to go to. Do I go to this episode? Do I go to that episode? And, you know, I...
Make us proud, Barry. Be strong. Be strong.
I guess. So, okay. It's the hot tub. It's season 7. It's the hot tub. And I don't know why I absolutely hate this, but this is where... This to me was... This was like an episode of Friends somehow creeped into Seinfeld and did it. And this is the one where Kramer decides to put the hot tub in his apartment. The only thing that I truly like about this episode, and I don't even like it, is where they bring the marathon runner, which is Jean-Paul, and they bring him to the New York City Marathon, and they screw it up for him. But I just found that this became so complicated, and it was like why? And I hate the TV show Friends, and if anybody likes Friends, then I'm sorry, but at the same time, I hated that show, and that's what this was. Let's see how much we can put in, and let's see how crazy we can make this story, and none of it works, and none of it's funny, and I couldn't stand it. This was the one that when I see it on, I go, you know what? Maybe I'll just see if the news is on because I don't want to watch it.
Jean-Paul, the marathon runner.
You actually like this episode a little bit, if I'm correct.
No, yeah, I like the bit where, you know, Kramer nods his head and goes, okay, my alarm's set. And he's like, I thought you were going to set your alarm. I must hit the snooze button. So that, you know, I don't think this is one of the best episodes, but I don't think it's one of the worst either. But, I mean, I get your point.
All right, fair enough.
So, okay, my number one episode... After much consideration and much thought, as Barry said, I think I'm in agreement with Barry that the finale is the ultimate stinkeroo in the show's history. But if I'm going to pick one that's a real fart in church, excuse the expression there, Mom and Dad, it's the dog where Jerry is babysitting Farfel, the dog that is owned by the guy that Jerry met on the plane. And Jerry doesn't know what's happened to this guy. The dog is barking incessantly. Jerry doesn't want to liquidate the dog. He's given some consideration to it. But the only good part about this whole episode to me is that they want to go to a movie, and the movie they want to go see is called, Barry? Prognosis Negative.
Yeah, I was going to say Roxanne, or whatever it was, musical.
That was Rochelle.
Rochelle. So on that note, you can't even say it. Liquidate the dog. You are such a dog person. Yeah. You have to say liquidate the dog. God bless you, Jeff Baldwin.
Yeah. The movie, the other one you were talking about was Rochelle, One Woman's Erotic Journey from Milan to Minsk.
Yes, you're 100% right.
But no, this episode sucks. Yeah, yeah, it was not a good episode. The trivia you had, the guy that played the owner of the dog, what did you tell me that he had done previously that we would know him from?
He was in Goodfellas. He was in Tim Burton's Mars Attacks, but he's also in a polarizing movie that you and I always argue, and our producer, the great Brian Last, always argues about. He was one of the main characters in the movie Funny Farm.
That's right. And we're talking about the actor whose name is Joseph Mayer, correct?
Correct.
He's a guy I'm just looking up on IMDb. He was in and Out, which Kevin Kline movie that I thought was hilarious. So
he did a lot. This Joseph Mayer was in a lot going back, you know, in the 80s and I guess in the early 90s too. And no fault of his that this didn't work. Jerry with the dog. It wasn't a great premise. And the dog named Farfel. What's that about?
Just as you said, not good stuff. Okay, folks, that's going to do it for this episode of Breaking Kayfabe with Baldwin and Barry. I would like to encourage you to follow me on Twitter at Baldwin Jeff. Breaking Kayfabe, my book, as I mentioned earlier, still available at crowbarpress.com. I'd like to give a shout out to the great Brian Last and the Arcadian Vanguard Podcast Network. Breaking Kayfabe is a production of the Arcadian Vanguard Podcast Network. Barry, any last words for our listeners?
No, you know what? This has been so much fun. I'm going to give a couple of shout-outs. We've been giving shout-outs every week. Jamie Ward, he's a huge Seinfeld fan. His friends actually call him Newman. So I told him I'd give him a shout-out. But, you know,
Jamie's a mailman, right? Jamie's a mailman.
He's a mailman, exactly. Yeah. I love hearing all of the comments, whether it's in our Facebook group, which, Jeff, you should give a plug for our Facebook group.
Facebook.com/BreakingKayfabe. Please feel free to join us. We, a lot of times, will post links to the matches that we discuss. And when we did an episode on the documentaries and movies, we post links to the movies. So you can always avail yourself the opportunity to join us there.
Absolutely, too. And yeah, we love doing it. We love that you guys are a part of it. Happy New Year. Welcome to 2018. Big things coming from us, Jeff. I know that is for a fact.
That's only a rumor. I will say in closing, one last thing, just because as we're taping this, I know he's getting ready to go to Japan. Our friend Eric Cholminsky was recently posting that not only did they meet the goal they had set to get some money for the wrestler in Japan that had been injured, which I'm completely drawing a blank on now. I'm sorry, Eric.
Takayama?
Yes, Takayama. But they shattered the goal, and they were over over $5,000 that they've raised for this wrestler that was injured during a match. And so big shout out to Eric, and a job well done, my friend, and enjoy your trip to Japan, and enjoy watching the Tokyo Dome show, you bastard, because I wish I was there with you. So anyway, until next time, for Barry Rose, this is Jeff Baudrin. Have a good one.